Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. The Chinese president's visit to Russia is historic for a number of reasons. First, to accent the growing Russia-China strategic partnership, and second, to demonstrate what both countries publicly advocate, the transition to a multipolar world beyond American hegemony. Crosstalking Russia-China relations, I'm joined by my guest, Matthew Arendt, in Tokyo. He is a senior fellow at the American University in Moscow and director of the Rising Foundation of Canada. In Hong Kong, we have Andrew Leung. He is an international and independent China strategist. And in Houston, we cross to Robert Buzalko. He is a professor of history at the University of Houston, as well as co-host of the Green and Red podcast. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. Andrew, let me go to you first in Hong Kong. You know, there's a very interesting juxtaposition. If you turn on American television, they're all wondering if Donald Trump is going to be arrested later this week for hush money and things like that, or they're talking about Hunter Biden's laptop still. And as they're doing that, we have a world historic meeting going on here in Moscow with the Chinese president's visit. I mean, how out of touch is the West when it comes to the burgeoning relationship between Moscow and Beijing? Go ahead, Andrew, in Hong Kong.
Well, I think that the West, led by the United States, is seized by the mantra of A, that the American-led so-called liberal order should there to stay forever, led by American hegemony. Because the West is regarded as the best system in the world, it should be imposed on all countries. And the whole rivalry with China and Russia is hyped to be a contest between democracy and authoritarianism. So there is a lot of false rhetoric. I will explain why, because as of only about a few days ago, according to the latest research by a Paris-based independent research institution called the IPSOS, looking at the happiness index of countries around the world as to what extent people in different countries are feel happy under their government. Guess what? China came on top. And the number two is Saudi Arabia. Well, these are two are not democracies, but yet their people have never felt happier than before. This is because their lives of the, as far as China is concerned, the lives of the vast majority of the people have been miraculously transformed under the tutelage of the Chinese Communist Party for the past 40 years. And this has been confirmed also the support of the people of their government, confirmed also by Harvard Kennedy School study a year and a half ago, and by the Edelman, E-D-E-L-M-A-N, Trust Barometer based in New York. So this rhetoric about a contest between democracy and autocracy, as if democracy, the democratic country in the world, typified by the United States, is the happiest, most successful country. As you just said, I mean, previous President Donald Trump is about to be arrested, committing all sorts of crimes and let alone some immoral acts.
Well, that's the whole point I was trying to make. I mean, there seems to be, you know, what countries in sync, what countries are in sync and which ones aren't, okay? Let me go to Robert in Houston. I mean, this is a very important event with the backdrop of China has proposed a 12-point peace process for Ukraine. Just recently brokered a deal between Saudi Arabia in Iran. President Assad visited Moscow recently. There's a lot of things going on in the world here, and it's not necessarily, you know, the West sees it as a threat to their hegemony, but a lot of other actors welcome this as a realignment of forces in the world. I mean, it's something a lot of people in the world actually embrace and are not afraid of. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, that's a key point. The media right now is covering the Xi Putin meetings, but it's, you know, kind of resurfacing that old Cold War rhetoric. And you know, I think that's a point Americans don't understand, because we kind of get, you know, a very different approach to the war here from the media, which is very much based in these kind of moral terms, good and evil, and it's very simplistic. But, you know, as you pointed out, I think the rest of the world clearly sees it differently. You know, so you have Western Europe and the United States, but that is presented kind of as the dominant, if not only, way of looking at things, and that's clearly not the case. So the United States, you know, has been waging this war economically, especially against China, for about a decade or so now. And, you know, the U.S. still has the biggest economy in the world. The dollar is still used for global, as a global currency. But China now has a significant manufacturing lead on the United States. The Chinese are trading in Asia with Russia all over the world, including with the United States, has a huge trade balance with the U.S. as well. And so then this peace proposal, along with the brokering negotiations between Saudi and Iran, show kind of a diplomatic offensive as well. So in all of these ways, the United States sees its hegemony, you know, being challenged, if not teetering. And so, you know, it's kind of using the one thing left in its pocket, which is this massive military budgets.
Robert, don't you find it really interesting? Is that, you know, just on in the last news cycle on Fox News, they were the guests were talking about the loss of American hegemony, and I think it's so kind of out of sync. Again, let me go to Matthew on this. Is that the world is tired of American hegemony? That's why it's being challenged, and that's why different centers of power are coming into being, particularly the strategic relationship between Russia and China. It's really interesting how the West always finds this threatening, but for other countries, particularly Russia and China, they find it liberating to be done with American hegemony. It's really amazing the different mindsets here. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I mean, Anglo-American, I'll say Anglo just to infuse a little bit of, I think, drama into the causal nexus of the post-World War II age, has had 80 plus years to prove itself and demonstrates its superiority as the best of all possible orders. And what we've seen is just simply hundreds of regime change operations carried out since Mossadegh in Iran and even in Nicaragua before that, and all the way up to the present order, assassinations of leaders of different heads of state, including America's own leaders who tried to resist this deep state fifth column built up inside of its heart. So you had a lot of time to prove that this system is the superior order, and we've had Libya, Iraq, Syria thrown back into dark age chaos situations in the name of democracy building of the rules-based international order. And I mean, if you just read the Chinese both their global security initiative, but also the U.S. hegemony and its perils, another document outlining its philosophy of how governance and especially on security should operate, back on February 21st and 22nd, it really lays out that, look, the only thing that works is win-win cooperation and looking for points of collaboration, which manifest in things like the Iran-Saudi Arabia entente, the Turkey-Syria relationship beginning to reheal slowly. Right. This works. Africa works. I mean, the development for Africa works. And so I think what we see coming in with Xi Jinping's visit to Russia has been a real hope for the third world. I don't even want to say the third world, but the world that's been prevented from developing and becoming modern for the past 8 years.
Matthew, I refer to it as the global majority, and because that's exactly what it is here. Let me go back to Andrew in Hong Kong. I guess what really gets American foreign policy people upset is that China is proposing peace around the world, you know, brokering, you know, Saudi Arabia and Iran, you know, that was a tough one to do. The United States was not in a position to do it because it chooses sides. China didn't choose a side. That's why we have a peace process there, potential peace process, put it that way. Go ahead, Andrew.
Well, I think that geopolitics not usually dictated by philosophies, as is dictated usually by the change of power. Power in terms of economic power, geopolitical power, and all these dynamics are changing all the time. After the Second World War, of course, the only largest and most powerful country had been the United States, and they have been able to call the shots. And then they thought that, let's bring China into their system so that any kind of cheap goods can be outsourced to China, together with the polluting industries, and then they reap the best of the benefits. They were sitting on top of the pile without realizing that China, having joined the WTO, as growing its economy, now the second largest, and is growing to be the world's largest trader, ahead of the United States and the largest manufacturer, and the center of the supply and value chain. And everything is almost making, almost everything is made in China. If you go to the supermarkets, and then even if it's, the product is not marked made in China, China is embedded in it somewhere in terms of logistics, in terms of components, in terms of materials. That's the reality. And then, of course, China is now seen to be eating Americans' lunch, no longer exporting only cheap goods, but also high technology goods. And in some measure,
well,
in some
Andrew, let me jump in here. I want to get Robert in before we go to the bank. Andrew brings up an interesting point. I mean, why does one country have to be number one? Why can't there be a multipolar world? I mean, that's it. That's what the Chinese and the Russians are asking. Why do we need a hegemon, Robert?
No, exactly. And especially for the last 30 years, since the early 90s, the United States has had, you know, kind of really overwhelming dominance. And we're seeing that challenge now, especially from China. And you have these really grave problems, you know, global warming. This UN just released another really dire report, which are being set aside. And in the U.S., we have this resurfacing of Cold War rhetoric based on military aggression, especially military power, massive defense budgets, because I think, like I said, that's what the U.S. has left. That's its last major, you know, play, which is, you know, kind of military power, you know, building weapons, building missiles, nuclear weapons, bases all over the world, almost 800 bases, overseas bases.
Yeah, okay, Robert, I have to jump in here. We're going to go to a break here. But why does it being number one have to be the military? Why can't it be, you know, prosperity or trade? I mean, that would,
well,
it seems to me that is something.
I'm
going to let you get an answer that when we get back from our break. Gentlemen, okay. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on some real news. Stay with RT. Welcome back to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter LaBelle. To remind you, we're discussing Russia-China relations. Okay, let's go back to Robert in Houston. I want you to finish off your answer before we went to our break here. I mean, Matthew's already touched on it, Robert, but, you know, this whole hegemony model with rules-based order, whatever that means, it's not working. It's not working for the vast majority of the world, and that's why we see these movements to get away from it. The financial control and the dollar, all of this, because that's just a weapon. It's a cudgel, okay? And more countries say they don't want to be fall victim to that. They want prosperity and they want security. That's not ideological for the vast majority of the world. But American hegemony, as seen in Washington, in London, in Brussels, maybe even Kiev, is very ideological. Go ahead, Robert.
Yeah, well, it's not working for the United States, for Americans either. You know, it might be for the top 1% or the top 10%.
Agreed.
Crises right now, you know, banking, wages. The healthcare system in the United States is in really terrible condition, housing, debt. And so in lieu of taking actions that would, you know, kind of alleviate these problems because of the United States now, we're kind of resurfacing the Cold War and McCarthyism. You know, that would be socialist, right? Healthcare would be socialism in the U.S. So instead, you know, you kind of make this play for hegemony based on this military strength, this military power. You create these John Quincy Adams called them monsters to destroy long ago. Right after World War II, George Kennan, famous diplomat, said the U.S. has 6% of the population and 50% of the wealth, and our task is to maintain this position of disparity. And that's really still American policy, you know, to maintain the power, to maintain that grip on power. And it used to sell the idea to Americans that you would get prosperity from that, you know, in Detroit, in the steel mills and places like that. That's not there anymore. Now it's based on fear and all of these other, you know, problems that emerge. And so you talk about things like China and Russia rather than global warming, which is obviously, you know, a grave crisis, you know, threatening the extinction of the entire planet. And in the U.S., we're just not really discussing it or doing much about it.
Yeah, well, I don't really see any meaningful political discussion in the United States, if you watch cable news anyway. You know, Matthew, you know, I started out by talking about, you know, a multipolar world and how both Russia and China are working towards it. Now, I think that's a very smart idea. It's for security reasons, it's very smart. But it's very practical and pragmatic because the West war against Russia is to take Russia out, break it up, and then go take on China. And the Chinese and the Russians both know that. Go ahead, Matthew.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, divide and conquer has been the age-old formula that's been applied again and again for centuries. Obviously, the nuclear bomb had really distorted or thrown off that formula for the past 80 years. But Zbigniew Brzezinski said it directly in 1997 that, you know, he laid out the designs for, what is it, something like 12 micro-federations with ethno-nationalistic orientations that should be put under the dominance of the U.S., of the IMF. If the Yeltsin doctrine, the Soros doctrine that had taken control of Russia back in the 1990s had been not subverted by actual patriots and nationalists who didn't want to sacrifice their heritage on this altar of the New World Order. So it's been said again and again in various ways. We have similar U.S. think tanks that have images of a carved up China, highly reduced in size with maybe six little micro federations under the control of the World Bank and IMF. And China sees that the Ukraine formula is being applied in its own backyard in the guise of both Taiwan and Japan, which have their own sort of similarities to the Ukraine situation in their own way. And a complete, you know, full spectrum military dominance. Military buildup around their perimeter, just like in Russia. And we have the same discussion in the Arctic. So they see where things are going. And they see that the U.S. is sitting on the biggest time bomb called the financial bubble, is only a matter of time before it collapses.
Oh, yeah.
So that's a big factor.
Yeah, yeah. Look who has problems with debt, and I can tell you who's going to be a problem in the world, okay? You know, Andrew, it's very interesting to me is that, you know, everyone likes to say that this is a marriage of convenience, the Russians and the Chinese, but actually, I look at it this way, is that, you know, Russia and China are accused of being revisionist powers. Actually, they're status quo powers. They want to appeal to the United Nations Charter. And the rules-based order has nothing to do with the UN Charter. But, you know, with Western propaganda, it's actually quite sophisticated and it's ubiquitous, you know. But there is a huge distinction between looking towards the Charter and this rules-based order. Andrew.
Well, of course, the special relationship between Russia and China is the product of several very powerful dynamic forces. First of all, the relationship already started, very close relationship already started well before the current Ukraine war. I mean, because both countries are extremely complementary economically. Russia has been one of the world's largest exporter of energy, gas and oil, as well as minerals, but also agricultural products. Russia is the world's perhaps largest exporter of agricultural fertilizers, and then China is the world's largest customer for both energy and for agricultural products. So naturally, the two countries are intertwined together well before the Ukraine war. Now,
I'd like to point out that neither one of these countries want to export their model to the other one. Okay, that's a respect of sovereignty. Okay, and again, that doesn't go along with the rules-based order because everyone has to be recreated in the image of the liberal order, which the world does not want. We know that. Okay, yeah, let me go to Robert right now. It's interesting, reading the pages of Politico, it's interesting that the Zelensky regime is very hesitant to criticize China. So we have a client state, 100% client state of the West, of the United States, and they are hesitating now because they see the role that Russia and China are playing on the world stage. That tells you everything you really need to know. A client state is beginning, wants to hedge their bets. Very interesting. Robert, go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, China is the big issue for the United States, for American policymakers, more than anything else, because China, you know, is now a threat to American hegemony, American power, especially economic power, manufacturing, trade, everything else. And so that's why talks, you know, are really being shot down in the U.S. before they even begin. The Wall Street Journal, you know, kind of the official organ of the American ruling elite, has said, you know, talks are a non-starter, you know, you can't have negotiations. And you know, the Chinese model has worked. And as you pointed out, I think it's kind of what the U.S. did at the end of the 19th and early 20th centuries. It's sending out trade missions. It's sending out diplomats. You know, the Belt and Road Initiative, these peace talks between the Saudis and Iranians And so it's saying, hey, we have, you know, in Central Asia and Africa, in the Middle East, it's saying we have something to offer you. And you're right, it's not really based on, you know, kind of a commitment to have the same kind of political system or political ideology. It's this idea, you know, the United States called it the open door, you know, at the end of the 19th and early 20th century. And that's kind of what the Chinese are doing. They're not saying, hey, we're going to come in here, we're going to blow you to bits, we're going to send you military equipment, we're going to fund proxy armies. What they're saying is we're going to, you know, extend trade, we're going to help you develop some kind of manufacturing base, we're going to help you, you know, the word back in the 20th century would have been modernize. And it's working, you know, and much of the world now, China has this diplomatic initiative, this political initiative that obviously terrifies the United States.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you have issues like Ukraine, which has been a real boom for Raytheon and General Dynamics and companies like that, for NATO, right? It gives NATO a reason to exist, another reason to exist. But for, you know, the globe and for the people in the United States here, like I said before, we're not benefiting from this military industrial complex either. You know, and you could say in the 50s or 60s, the U.S. was, typical American was, but now, you know, personal debt, student debt, a deteriorating healthcare system, horrible infrastructure, train derailments every day, horrible, you know, pollution problems. So it's a fairly grave political crisis. And the United States is focusing on, you know, these talks between Putin and Xi or you know, kind of it's taking these ancillary issues and blowing them up rather than dealing with the real problems we face, which is, you know, absolutely a really significant challenge to this neoliberal order, as well as an alternative to this kind of American system, which kind of gone over
the neoliberal order is just as bad for the United States as it is for other countries. For the life of me, why the American Congress pays Ukrainian pensions, but it won't take care of pensioners in America or veterans or any other group? Okay, it's really extraordinary.
Okay. Biden's throwing billions around, but no money for East Palestine, Ohio, where there's trade derailment.
Good point. Matthew, you know, one of the biggest difference we see right now is that, you know, ever since the end of the Cold War, the great powers didn't confront each other. They had proxy wars all over the place here. They didn't go toe-to-toe. But now we see elements within the American administration that want to go toe-to-toe with Russia and China at the same time. Great powers traditionally don't go after each other. You know why? Because you can fail. It's existential. That's why we live in a very dangerous time. We have great powers, the United States, confronting other great powers. That's a no-no, because you can lose. Matthew.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, again, as I mentioned earlier, the advent of the nuclear bomb really changed the calculus of how global empire could ever function again. And throughout the Cold War period of the mutually assured destruction formula that was set out by folks like Bertrand Russell, it sort of had a balance of terror that didn't result in destroying everything. But now we're at a point where we have a systemic breakdown. And I think that factor of the transatlantic systemic banking meltdown, but it's not just the banking, it's the physical infrastructure, the physical means of production, which have been atrophied consistently for 50 plus years, are now variables that are shaping the thinking of certain fanatics who unfortunately have access to the launch mechanisms of many of these nuclear warheads, who can do nothing but double down on the script that they had laid out back in 1991, 92, when the world was one. It was the, you know, end of nation states and a one world government was here, end of history. And they seem to still hold on to the delusion that script still applies to the current age, despite the fact that reality has completely changed from their ivory tower. And I think you see some signs of major infighting amongst different factions of oligarchical interests right now, where some are saying, you know, well, maybe we should like live to fight another day and abort this plan. I think the Jeffrey Sachs angle is playing a role in that. And then on other angles, you have the more fanatical neocon drive of just, you know, we can do nothing but what we're programmed to do, which is hegemony with no negotiation. And that's scary. It's a very scary prospect.
That's how we end the program. It's scary. It certainly is, gentlemen. That's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Tokyo, Houston, and in Hong Kong. And I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. And remember, Crosstalk rules.